minds aglow with whirling, transient nodes of thought, careening through a cosmic vapor of invention.
Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Yes, comrades. Some of you may have seen Dr. J on the TV, on the boob tube yesterday. I had four separate television interviews because I happen to be the only person in Connecticut during the holidays who was willing to talk about this topic and address the kooky Raelian cult and all of its glory. And I'm sure that the people who interviewed me got quite a surprise when they found out what my views were on it. We made a pact that if they could find anybody who was more supportive of human cloning than me, their $100 would change hands. But at any rate, I thought I would bring in today two short editorials, one by me and one by my good friend Professor Bostrom at Yale, about cloning. Also, a recent editorial I wrote about designer babies, which is a closely related issue about the Americans' attitudes towards cloning and genetic engineering and the enhancement of human techniques. And if we get the chance, a wonderful article from Wired magazine about how China is going to kick our rear ends in the cloning race because they don't have as many religious qualms about it as we do. And then finally, I've got some wonderful stuff about Cuba's. So listen up, all you lefty technophobes out there. Cuba's use of genetic engineering. And finally, well, just more stuff to annoy those who are concerned. Bye, Richard. Thank you. As Richard goes off to fight the good fight against the American war, I'm here to fight the good fight for reproductive autonomy. Okay, so let's start off here. This is an editorial I wrote and had published actually in the Hartford Courant, for those of you who didn't catch it. It was published sometime in the middle of November. And it starts this way. Last year, the Bush administration and pro-life, by the way, in the background, I'm sorry to interrupt myself, but in the background, you're listening to Philip Glass's Anima Mundi. I thought it was an appropriate background music for this. Last year, the Bush administration and pro-life Republicans in Congress killed legislation to ban reproductive cloning to make babies, by insisting that the bills also ban cloning for research purposes. Now the Bush administration and the Vatican are blocking a resolution at the United Nations to ban reproductive cloning. Again, they are insisting that the resolution go further to forbid any use of cloned embryos in research, which the UN committee will not agree to. Generally, I seethe over Bush's attacks on multilateralism and world law, but in this case, I welcome the fact that they are a roadblock in this silly stampede. To be sure, reproductive cloning is not currently safe, and any group or doctor offering it to desperate parents should be barred from doing so. Now, we'll talk in a second, or I'll talk to myself at least in a second about how that reflects on the current Raelian episode. The National Academy of Sciences and the Clinton-era National Bioethics Advisory Committee called for a 5-year moratorium on human cloning to allow time for the technique to be perfected. Note, they called for a moratorium, not a ban. But once human cloning is safe, there are no sound ethical reasons to forbid its use by would-be parents, which is why they called for a moratorium and not a ban. The timing and kind of children we bear are the most personal and life-changing decisions we can make, which is why our reproductive freedoms are so important. The right to use cloning, once safe, should be another reproductive choice to be protected, along with contraception and abortion. Not long ago, bad science fiction movies and religious dogmas were arrayed against test tube babies. Today, in vitro fertilization is an accepted, mundane, and widely used tool. Just as with in vitro fertilization, opponents of reproductive cloning deploy a dozen tenuous hypothetical scenarios in which society or the clones would be harmed by cloning. But none of these makeshift reasons are weighty enough to deny people the right to control their own reproduction. Now, again, I'm saying once it's safe, it's not currently safe, and I'll talk about that in a second. Francis Fukuyama of the President's Council on Bioethics warns that fathers will lust after daughters cloned from their mothers, since they will resemble the mother as a young girl. Yet this is really an argument for adoption, since many girls resemble their mothers. Opponents worry about a Brave New World and the supposed slippery slope to totalitarianism, but the problem with reproduction in the novel Brave New World was precisely that control over baby-making had been taken away from parents and given to the state. Dictators don't need to clone armies when they can build them more cheaply and quickly the old way, which is through brainwashing. Opponents also fret that clones will face inordinate expectations from their parents. But if clones are harmed by their parents' expectations, especially the expectation that their kids have the same tastes, values, and abilities as their parents, then very few people should have children at all, because don't all parents have those expectations? And isn't it, wouldn't we consider a parent that didn't have those expectations to be a bizarre and not really a good parent? A parent that didn't try to pass on some kind of values or some kind of expectations to their kids for achievement. Some argue that cloning would only be available to the wealthy and that there will be better ways to use these resources. But that's also true of fertility treatments in general. We can only achieve equitable access to healthcare by creating a national health insurance system, not by banning elective out-of-pocket services. That's like saying people are wasting money on liposuction and getting nose jobs, and therefore we should ban liposuction and nose jobs, and somehow that's going to make everybody have equal access to healthcare. That's absurd. That's not the way it works. Finally, some argue that people will be harmed by not being biologically unique. Of course, no one's DNA should be used without their permission. Absolutely. But where does the harm come from in having a twin? Most twins appear to value their closeness. As annoyed as we can be by our similarities to our parents, they are also important to the parent-child bond. Clones will simply be delayed twins and beloved children, with all the rights and burdens of any child. The right to have a clone child, like the right to wear a red hat, is not an important right in the scheme of things. But if we take away this right because of irrational fears, we will have lost a small measure of our freedom for no gain. Until the global hysteria about cloning settles, here is one small cheer for the Bush administration's ham-handed obstruction of efforts to ban it altogether. That was an editorial I published in the Hartford Courant, and it's also it's on my website at changesurfer.com. My title was Don't Ban Human Cloning, Just Make It Safe. And it certainly reflects on the current dilemma about the Raelians. There is no international law. Right? Presumably the Raelians didn't clone this baby in the United States, even though there is no law in the United States which would forbid it, as I said, because the Bush administration killed that law. Although there probably will be a law in this Congress. But there also is no international treaty, although a number of countries around the world have laws against human reproductive cloning. However, the Raelians presumably were acting in a country which does not have such a law, and even though the FDA says it's launched an investigation in the United States, all it's investigating is whether the practice did not seek sufficient prior notification of the FDA for them to determine whether it was safe or not. And that is the principal concern here. Given what we know about mammal cloning, a lot of which happens right here at the University of Connecticut and for cattle and so on, it takes an enormous number of embryos to have a successful cloned product to implant. And then the in vitro fertilization process has a very low success rate, many miscarries. This group, CloneAid, the Raelian cult-backed scientific effort, they claimed that only 10 embryos were used and 5 were successful products of their cloning efforts. And that seems an extraordinarily successful rate, especially for a group that has no prior track record with these techniques. So that's the reason that many people are suspicious. On the other hand, Boussillier, the woman who's heading up this effort, she has said that they will be submitting the child and the mother to genetic testing, DNA testing with a third party, a person from ABC News who's arranging this to determine whether they are in fact clones, and it should be pretty clear. And I can't believe that they would submit them for this test if they knew that the results were not going to come back and validate what they say. So I think it seems pretty likely that there will be, in fact, evidence, if not from this test. There are two other groups, Antonori and Zavos, the Dr. Zavos and Dr. Antonori, from Italy and the United States, who are also working on cloning babies around the world. There will be clones sometime in the next year, human clones. And the question is, is it ethical to do now? My position is no, because there are too many genetic anomalies, and it takes too many eggs, and it takes too much wear and tear on women at this particular point. However, as I said in this editorial, I don't think that eventually, once these techniques are perfected, which should be 5 or 10 years, that it would be unsafe, and at that point it should absolutely be one of our reproductive freedoms. Stay tuned, and we'll be back in just a second with an editorial from Dr. Nick Bostrom, also about the ethics of human cloning. This is an essay from Dr. Nick Bostrom. He's the chair of the World Transhumanist Association, which I'm the secretary of, and so we see pretty much eye to eye, but he's a philosopher at Yale and shortly to be of Oxford, where he's going to take a three-year chair. Imagine that you're one of the human clones that will be born. There's no doubt that this will happen sooner or later, blah, blah, blah. And imagine yourself listening into the current arguments for making cloning illegal. You hear people opining that cloning threatens human dignity, that it would be playing God, that it represents a slippery slope towards a dehumanized future, that everybody has a right to a unique genome, except identical twins, apparently, or an unknown genome, and so forth. How would it make you feel? To hear all these dignified people talking about you as if your very existence were a crime against humanity? Such an imaginary point of view helps put things in perspective. There is one argument that, as a future clone, you might understand and agree with. Concerns about the safety of the procedure. The argument that we ought to wait to try it on humans until we have perfected the method on animals makes some degree of sense. But even so, suppose you were a slightly deformed human clone. Would you agree that it was a terrible moral offense that to have caused you to come into existence? Historically, we find that many a great medical breakthrough, now seen as a blessing, was in its own time ferociously condemned by bioconservative moralists. This was the case with anesthesia during surgery and childbirth. People argued that it was unnatural and that it would weaken our moral fiber. It was also the case with heart transplantations. How yucky to take a living heart out of one person and put it in the chest of another. And it was the case with in vitro fertilization. These test tube babies would be dehumanized and would be subject to grave psychological abuse. Now, of course, anesthesia is taken for granted. Heart transplantation is seen as one of medicine's greatest triumphs, and the public approval rate of IVF is up from 15% in the early 70s to over 70% today. What can we learn from these historical episodes? We can learn that our immediate emotional reactions to medical developments are not a reliable guide to their morality. We can learn that we are prone to prejudice and to narrow-minded failure to appreciate the long-term benefits of technological development. We can learn that the yuck factor should be profoundly distrusted and that it should definitely not be glorified, as Leon Cass, the chair of the President's Council on Bioethics, does, as a wisdom of repugnance. We all have a moral responsibility to recognize the clone for what she is, a unique human person with just as much human dignity as those of us who were conceived in other ways. By the time the first human clone becomes an adult, the moral debates over cloning may already be long forgotten. The present opponents of cloning may have retired or moved on to being outraged about other things. The clone may be spared having witnessed being referred to by pundits in such derogatory language as we hear today. In the scheme of things, cloning will not significantly change the world. Some people will owe their lives to this technology, and some infertile couples will be grateful for having had the chance to raise a child of their own that they would otherwise have lacked. Some people may misguidedly use cloning to try to bring back a lost child or loved one, not realizing that personal identity is not reducible to genetic identity. Some people may choose to have a child that is a clone of a stranger they admire, perhaps a great scientist, athlete, or religious leader. Yet if the current level of demand for elite sperm or elite eggs is any indication, the class of people who will choose to do this will be a tiny minority. Meanwhile, other areas of technology will be advancing fast and furious, leading to developments that will overshadow cloning. Some of these developments will be truly frightening. Genetically engineered biowarfare agents, for example, and new weapons based on molecular nanotechnology. Those prospects deserve our serious attention and concern. Other developments will open up unprecedented opportunities for human growth and flourishing. One day we will find ways of halting and reversing the aging process. We will have the option of extending our intellectual, physical, emotional, and spiritual capacities far beyond the levels that are possible today. This will be the end of humanity's childhood and the beginning of a post-human era. Our descendants, or even you and I, if we manage to stay alive until then, will look back on today and today's primitive condition in much the way that we look back on our humanoid ancestors before they developed language, learned to use fire, and took up agriculture. Few of us would want to go back to that stage, and in the future, few will want to return to the present day. We have a choice. We can work against developments that will make us post-human and join the reactionary forces that decry each new technological breakthrough that changes human nature. Or we can stand by the sidelines and passively watch the future unfold. Or we can actively participate in creating the future that will enable us to reach almost unimaginable levels of human flourishing and well-being through the use of advanced technology to defeat disease and aging and to increase our human capacities to entirely new levels. For those who choose this third option, and this is where he comes in with the plug, the World Transhumanist Association offers an opportunity to join others in the effort to make our worthiest dreams come true. Your help is needed. That's Dr. Nick Bostrom. He's a philosopher at Yale and soon to be of Oxford, unfortunately, where he's leaving our fine shores. They gave him lots of money over there.
Same clothes. In the future, everyone will be very fat from the starchy diet. In the future, everyone will be very thin from not having enough to eat. In the future, it will be next to impossible to tell girls from boys, even in bed. In the future, men will be super masculine and women will be ultra feminine. In the future, half of us will be mentally ill. In the future, there will be no religion or spiritualism of any sort. In the future, the psychic arts will be put to practical use. In the future, we will not think that nature is beautiful. In the future, the weather will always be the same. In the future, no one will fight with anyone else. In the future, there will be an atomic war. In the future, water will be expensive. In the future, all material items will be free. In the future, everyone's house will be like a little fortress.
Sorry for the abrupt introduction of that tune. That's one of my favorite tunes from David Byrne, In the Future. A compendium of all the dystopian and utopian ideas that he had read across that day, probably. Okay, here's another editorial from the pen of Dr. J, written this morning, much to my wife's displeasure, but I was inspired by having been a five-minute media celebrity. You know, you give these 20-minute interviews to journalists, and actually only one quote got on, but at any rate. In this month's Wired magazine, in an article about China's commitment to cloning and stem cell research, which you can find at wired.com, Chinese scientists give voice to what is undoubtedly a widespread view in the world. Americans are so hamstrung by religious fundamentalism that our scientists will be forbidden to make breakthroughs in stem cells, genetics, and reproductive medicine. Fortunately, a new national poll reveals that a growing minority of Americans are anxious to throw off religious dogmas and future shock angst and embrace the brave new world. The New Genetics and Public Policy Center, which you can find at dnapolicy.org at Johns Hopkins University, conducted a survey of 1,200 adult Americans in October. It asked about attitudes towards 12 reproductive technologies ranging from prenatal diagnosis and in vitro fertilization to germline enhancement and human reproductive cloning. It found that 5% of Americans were opposed to all 12 technologies. Whether that meant they wanted them banned or not was not really clear. And a solid third of the population was broadly opposed to new reproductive technologies, even if used for health reasons, such as screening for handicaps. Conversely, there was 2% who were in favor of all 12 technologies, and a solid 20% of the population who broadly favored reproductive technology, including human cloning and enhancement. For instance, 18% of Americans polled approved of scientists working on ways to clone human beings. And there's, if you go to dnapolicy.org, you can see the detailed analysis of the survey and the original survey questions. Of course, you wouldn't know it from the way the survey was covered in the mainstream press, which focused on the fact that a majority of Americans endorsed health and safety regulation of reproductive technology. Hey! Most Americans think that cornflakes should be regulated so people don't get toxic sawdust, but that doesn't mean they want cornflakes banned. Even so, a surprising, even disturbing, in my opinion, 22% were opposed to the government regulating the quality and safety of genetic engineering, and 11% were opposed to regulations to limit the cloning of humans. So take heart, you reckless techno-libertarians out there, which I do not include myself among. There are a growing number of Americans whose petri dishes will have to be pried from their cold, dead fingers. Responses to the questions about germline enhancement were especially interesting and suggest a strategic opening for we partisans of procreative liberty. Almost 6 out of 10, that is 59% of Americans, approved of parents, quote, being able to change their own genes in order to prevent their children from having a genetic disease. Okay, so you get that, you take a genetic therapy, it changes your own reproductive cells, your sperm and your eggs, and then when you have children, they don't have whatever genetic disease that you carried. The interviewers emphasized the word own when they asked the questions. When the issue shifts, however, to germline enhancement, far fewer were in favor. Only 20% wanted to allow parents to change their own genes in order to have children who would be smarter, stronger, or better looking. There are two striking things here. First, changing one's own genes to change your kid's genes is germline modification, which is considered a huge no-no by self-appointed guardians of our genetic patrimony. The European Union has passed resolutions to forbid germline engineering. The proposed UN guidelines governing genetic engineering has suggested that this be made an international crime to do germline engineering. But it is one of the natural and almost inevitable corollaries of genetic therapy for genetic diseases for people themselves, because if you have a truly effective genetic therapy that goes all through your body, curing whatever genetic defects you have, eventually it's going to end up in your semen and in your ovaries, and it's going to change your reproductive cells as well. And of course, the most effective way to change genetic diseases is when you're an embryo or, at a very small stage of your development, and that would also change your reproductive cells. So, when you phrase this question about germline engineering in terms of people having a right to control their own bodies, and that is in terms of bodily autonomy, the majority of Americans at any rate, and presumably I think all around the world, the majority of people would say, heck yes, I have a right to control my own body. Now, the enhancement issue does give the majority of Americans pause, however. The striking thing about this 20% who are in favor of germline enhancement, which if there is an ultimate no-no in genetic science, some ethicists are willing to accept germline therapy if you get rid of the bad stuff. But when it comes to germline enhancement, which would fundamentally and for that genetic line permanently change the nature of humanity, they're opposed to that. 10% were in favor of it 8 years ago. 20% are in favor of it now. At that rate, just through linear increase, we would have a majority in favor of germline enhancement in 25 years. The two most important discriminators between the bioluddites and the techno-libertarians in this survey, especially for enhancement technologies, were gender and religiosity/secularism. Men and secularists were more likely to favor genetic technology and accounted for about 50 and 60% of the population, respectively. That is, men were 50%. The secularists in this survey were about 60% of the population. To the extent that they were concerned about genetic technology, the principal concerns of the secularists were, quote, that technologies can be easily used for the wrong purposes. Okay, that's something that you can address through public policy. You can make the wrong purposes illegal. However, the religious who were opposed to genetic technology were opposed because they were worried about human beings playing God. That concern can't be addressed through public policy. That's a Luddite concern. That's a concern that you can't argue. There's no way to convince anybody that human beings should be allowed to play God. Unfortunately, the religious BioLuddites said they felt much more strongly about these issues than secularists. For instance, more than half of the BioLuddites, those approving three or fewer technologies, say they feel very strongly about these issues, compared to only 26% of those who were supportive of genetic technology, those who approved nine or more of the technologies. The evangelical Christians said they felt more strongly about the issues, and women said they felt more strongly about the issues. So, you know, the people who are opposed to our genetic future and our rights to control our own body, they feel very strongly about those issues. Unfortunately, those of us who are in favor of controlling our own bodies and having technology at our disposal don't feel quite as strongly about it. These numbers should suggest some strategies for proponents of genetic self-determination. First, the religious BioLuddites are passionate but outnumbered and shrinking. When asked if respondents thought of these issues mainly in terms of health and safety or mainly in terms of religion and morality, 54% chose health and safety, and only 33% religion and morality. Now, I think you can have a religious and moral views, I do, that respect bodily autonomy, but religion and morality tend to be code words for anti-scientific religious dogmas here. Younger people were also much more supportive of these technologies than older people, especially the enhancement technologies. When push comes to shove, I suspect a majority of the moralizers will also want the tangible benefits to be had from gene therapy and stem cell research. But in the meantime, we need to be appealing to the younger we, that is, we, those of you who agree with me, need to be appealing to the younger secularist majority to get as riled up about their bodily autonomy as the aging religious BioLuddites. Second, women's concerns that a rampant scientific establishment will recklessly harm children and society needs to be addressed through strong health and safety regulations, while emphasizing the importance of reproductive freedom. And remember, a majority of women still favor abortion rights more than men. And the benefits for children that can come from using these technologies. Those appeals need to be made clear to women. Till we have uterine replicators, women will make the final decisions about whether the next generation will benefit from genetic science. So without women on board with these issues, we can't have tangible benefits from these technologies. As we face the storm of hysterical hand-wringing from the around the Raelian's newly cloned baby Eve, we do well to remember the old adage, educate, agitate, and organize. We are not alone, we who support technological progress. We are legion, but we have a hitherto silent constituency to rally. That was the latest editorial from the pen of me, Dr. J, and you can find the full panoply of Change Surfing editorials at changesurfer.com, also at betterhumans.com and transhumanism.com, where I am syndicated, and Better Humans and Transhumanity Magazine. You can check out recent editorials such as Why Menstruation Should Be Ended and Why Democracy is an Answer to Our Future Angst. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.